Chapter 22. Tapping Your Originality. One of the most important things a writer of fiction or nonfiction can do over time is to find his individual voice, style, and view of the world. The author's voice is made up of the many factors that distinguish an author from all other authors. Recognizing an individual author's voice is like recognizing a voice on the telephone. Many authors first find their voice when they learn to examine each word for its necessity, precision, and clarity, as we are doing here. The originality of some of the writers I have worked with was immediately apparent. James Baldwin and Bertram Wolfe come to mind. Among my recent students, a young man named Steve Tulski began his work this way. "I am the way, the answer, and the light. Through me all things are possible." He had written this once as a joke on the headboard of his bed. No one else I know, published or unpublished, could have written that beginning. More recently, when I saw the early pages of a completed novel by Anne James Valadez, my spirits rose in the hope that she could sustain the promise of those early pages, a thoroughly believable scene of two trees who were once lovers and now, rooted in place, can only report what goes on beneath their branches. Despite the rootedness of the trees, the story is anything but static. It is a work of remarkable originality. An extremely small percentage of writers show signs of an original voice at the outset. It usually develops over time and has two components, the originality of what is said and the originality of the way it is said. Over the years, I encountered writers who felt they didn't make their mark because what they wrote was not sufficiently different from what other writers write. I developed a teaching strategy, a way for writers to discover what they alone can do. It is a high-risk, high-gain experiment. Though it can be accomplished in minutes, it takes hard thought and perseverance. If the exercise works for you, it could tap your originality. I ask you to imagine yourself on a rooftop, the townspeople assembled below. You are allowed to shout down one last sentence. It is the sentence that the world will remember you by forever. If you say it loud enough, everyone in the world will hear you, no matter where they are. Think of shouting the sentence, even if you seldom shout. What one thing are you going to say? If you'd like to try that exercise now, write down the sentence. Is your sentence one that could have been said by any person you know? If so, revise it until you are convinced no one else could have said that sentence. When you've reworked your original sentence, consider these additional questions. Is your sentence outrageous? Could it be? Is your sentence a question? Would it be stronger as a question? Make whatever changes you like. I have still more questions. Would the crowd below cheer your sentence? Can you revise it to give them something they'd want to cheer? As you can see, I am asking question after question to help you strengthen and individualize your sentence. I continue. Suppose the person you most love in all the world were to strongly disagree with your sentence. Can you answer his or her disagreement in a second sentence? Please add it. Some writers will try to get out of further work by saying that their loved one would agree with the sentence. People have different scripts. If your sentence is original, the chances of another person, even your closest loved one, agreeing with it without the slightest exception is extremely unlikely. Has your second sentence weakened your first? It usually does. If so, make it stronger than the first. When you've done that, you now have the option of choosing one or the other sentence. There may be value in combining and condensing them. Finished? Now, imagine that you look down and see that the crowd below you is gone. You see only one person, your greatest enemy, who says, "I didn't hear you. Would you repeat that?" It is a fact that given one last sentence, addressing one's enemy can light up the imagination more than an anonymous crowd can. You don't want to give your enemy the last word or let him respond in a way that would demolish what you've said. Can you alter your sentence so that your statement will be enemy-proof? This, of course, continues the exercise with one of its most difficult phases, creating an original sentence that is strong and, to the best of the writer's ability, seemingly incontrovertible. Suppose you found out that the only way to get your message across would be if you whispered your sentence. How would you revise it so that it would be suitable for whispering? It isn't always easy to change a shouted sentence to one that can be whispered and heard, but it sometimes produces intriguing results and shows how the intent to whisper can produce words that are stronger than shouted words. The last thing I'll ask is for you to look at all of the versions of your sentence. Is there a prior version that is actually stronger than the last? Can the virtues of one be embodied in another? And most important, which sentence now strikes you as the most original, the one least likely to have been written by someone else? The first attempt at this exercise may not produce your ideal original expression. Save your results and try again. But my experience has been that often the first run of this exercise will direct you to a theme or expression of a theme that is uniquely yours. You have begun to tap your originality, to find your voice. In the meantime, you've had another lesson in the value of shunning the sentence that comes first, and honing, changing, polishing the words of a single sentence to test all of its possibilities. That is, after all, the writer's work. Chapter 23. The Door to Your Book. Titles That Attract. One day in 1962, an elderly woman with a marked Greek accent came to see me in my apartment in New York. Ilya Kazan's mother arrived holding in her hand an advance copy of her son's first book, America, America, which I was about to publish. Her voice betraying a slight quiver, she said that when the plays her son directed won Pulitzer Prizes and his direction of films twice won Academy Awards, her friends were not impressed because they, also Greek immigrants, did not go to the movies or see Broadway plays. Now, she said, holding America, America up triumphantly, at long last she had something that she could show her friends. The book, which had a modest first printing, was selected by the Reader's Digest Condensed Book Club, reprinted in mass-market paperback, translated into many languages, made into a film, and widely reviewed as the best fiction ever on the uniquely American theme of immigration. All of that might not have happened. When the manuscript arrived, Kazan's name for it was The Anatolian Smile, which, I thought, closed the door against a wide readership. The Anatolian Smile was not a title designed to attract readers, nor did it resonate with the book's grand theme, how a young man, beset by hardships of the old world, determined to emigrate to America, and stopped at nothing, even murder, to get to the United States. Given Kazan's considerable reputation as a director, and his known ability to say no in a voice designed to quash an opponent, others might have been tempted to go with the original title. Kazan's first book also happened to be the first book that I would be publishing under the Stein and Day imprint. My idealistic determination was to make every book a winner. That title, The Anatolian Smile, would not help. I contributed one word twice, the title America, America. I have met many talented writers who insulate their books from the public with titles that are not likely to arouse a reader's interest or to promise a rich experience. That stubbornness is persistent. Many years after Kazan's book left my care, he recycled his original title and had another publisher, perhaps less willing to oppose his strong will, issue a novel with the title The Anatolian. That was the first time one of his novels missed a run on the bestseller list. The author was the same, the quality of writing was the same. The title, an avoidable mistake, may have turned off the many millions who were part of his long-standing audience. The novel quickly dropped from sight, its door closed. A book's life depends on reviewers, booksellers, and readers. Picture a reviewer standing before shelves loaded with the many dozens of review copies that arrive from publishers each week. He can review only one. Which does he pull down from the shelf to see if he might be interested in reviewing it? Would he pull down a book called Arghawker? And how will people know Arghawker is wonderful if it doesn't get reviewed? Venture into any bookstore and look at the titles of new novels on display. Take note of your reactions to the titles of books by authors you don't know. You'll see how many books don't tempt you to pick them up because of their titles, and which titles intrigue you enough to want to take them down off the shelf and read the flaps. Titles are equally important in nonfiction. While the subject matter of an ordinary nonfiction book is often enough to attract initial interest to it, a lively title will help even a how-to book. As nonfiction ascends in ambition and achievement, the title becomes as influential as for a novel. One of the authors I worked with closely over many years was Bertram D. Wolfe, whose best work became classics. Wolfe wanted to do a biography of Diego Rivera, one of the great 20th-century painters Wolfe had known well. The hitch was that 2 decades earlier Wolfe had already written a biography of Diego Rivera that was published by Alfred A. Knopf, one of the finest publishers in America. The book was titled simply Diego Rivera. Though published in a beautiful edition, it did not do well. Wolfe put forward that Rivera had lived another 18 years after the first biography was published, the events of those years unrecorded. Moreover, Wolfe asserted, in the intervening years he had acquired more insight into the artist and his work, and so he embarked on a new biography, which he titled The Fabulous Life of Diego Rivera. Consider this. The author was the same. The subject was the same. But the title had a power and a resonance that the earlier title lacked. The new book was selected by a book club, nominated for a National Book Award, sold well, and became a standard work. I attribute that success in large measure to the excellent title of the second book. The Fabulous Life of Diego Rivera promised the reader much more than the earlier title. How do you go about finding the right title for a book? Let's look at a spectacular example of a bad title and how it was changed. In the early 80s, one of my editors brought in a manuscript by Cecil B. Curry, a graduate of the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College, a professor of military history, and the author of 8 previous books. The book described, sometimes in harrowing moment-by-moment detail, the destruction of an American infantry division in World War II. The manuscript, based on previously classified documents and first-hand testimony from both German and American survivors, demonstrated the tragic consequences of inept commanders. Despite the book's importance, I thought the author's straightforward title for it would kill sales. He called it The Battle of Schmidt. First, nobody had heard of a place called Schmidt, much less of a battle fought there. And Americans, including the members of our editorial board, couldn't keep from laughing at the sound of Schmidt, not an appropriate response to a serious book. What we needed was an intriguing title with the right resonance. Many effective titles have come from poems and songs, and I thought of a song that would likely be remembered by a prime audience for the book, the tens of thousands of infantry officers of World War II. In officers' training school at Fort Benning, Georgia, young men sometimes kept their spirits up during the 18 weeks of hell in Georgia by singing a ditty someone anonymous had composed to the tune of the Cornell University alma mater, High Above Cayuga's Waters. See if you can pick out the words that became the title of Cecil Curry's book. High above the Chattahoochee, near the Upatoy, stands an old abandoned shithouse, Benning School for Boys. Onward ever, backward never, follow me and die, to the port of embarkation, next of kin, goodbye. As you may have guessed, The Battle of Schmidt became Follow Me and Die, with the subtitle, The Destruction of an American Division in World War II. Follow Me was the motto of the infantry school, and the cynical use of it in the song had the perfect reverberation for the book, which went on to be selected by the Military Book Club and had a life in hardcover and later in paperback, none of which would likely have happened with the original title. Nonfiction titles are usually easier to come by because in the great majority of cases, the author can and does fall back on a short description of what the book is about. If Henry Kissinger calls his book Diplomacy, that's enough. But diplomacy by an author whose name is not widely known would be what book sales reps call a tough sell. What many nonfiction writers neglect is the appeal more imaginative titles hold for readers. Take the simple matter of making a book of shorter pieces of previously published nonfiction. Saul Bellow, whose novel titles are admirable, in 1994 published a collection called It All Adds Up. Some of the content is vintage Bellow, but if you're not familiar with Bellow's shorter nonfiction, would you hurry to look inside a book called It All Adds Up? The subtitle is no better, From the Dim Past to the Uncertain Future. John Updike published a collection that he called by the blah title Picked Up Pieces, which seems to minimize the content. Long ago, I published a collection of such pieces by Lionel Trilling, which he called by the charming title A Gathering of Fugitives. There is no reason to give any book a handicap in its title. Titles by academicians are sometimes intentionally dull in order to sound serious. However, Alan Bloom, a professor at the University of Chicago, presumably knew that a typical academic title might restrict his readership to other academicians. When he wrote a book on How Higher Education Has Failed Democracy and Impoverished the Souls of Today's Students, Professor Bloom called it The Closing of the American Mind, which surely contributed to the book's becoming a bestseller. Can an imaginative title help a how-to book? Indeed it can. I recall several people resisting the title of Joe Couder's first book, Advice from a Failure. "Who wants to listen to advice from a failure?" is what they said as we deliberated over the title. The author and I stuck with her provocative title. Advice from a Failure turned into a long-lasting popular success. Even better as a title was one that came with a child care manuscript from a pediatrician with sound advice and a sense of humor. He called his book How to Raise Children at Home in Your Spare Time. It was taken by 28 book clubs, and I'm certain the title helped. One of the more influential nonfiction editors of our time, Alice Mayhew, has a particular talent for devising resonant titles for major books. Witness All the President's Men, Den of Thieves, and Parting the Waters. Good article titles can help catch the attention of the reader browsing through a periodical. An intriguing title is sometimes sufficient to promote an article to the front cover of a magazine. James Thurber called one of his pieces The Secret Life of James Thurber. Readers are attracted to secrets the way anteaters are attracted to anthills. Edward Hoagland attracted attention to an article by calling it The Courage of Turtles. Most readers would not think of courage in the context of turtles. The title arouses curiosity. Long ago, William Hazlitt entitled an essay On the Pleasure of Hating. Hatred as a pleasure? The reader's curiosity piqued. He wants to see what the author has to say. A title that people respond to can spur completion of the work. For years, I'd been writing an autobiography called Passing for Normal, which I began working on seriously only after the title became known to my friends and they responded enthusiastically, without having read a word. I recall asking participants in one of my fiction weekends for their titles, and at least two of them were so good I hoped their novels in progress made it to publication. Driving in Neutral and Scenes from a Life in the Making. Good titles are hard to come by, even for some writers of the first rank. Consider a book once called The Parts Nobody Knows. Is it a medical text? The talented author retitled the book To Love and Write Well, which sounds amateurish, though the author was by that time world famous. Still struggling to find a title for the book, he tried again, this time calling it How Different It Was, which might excite some curiosity about what it is, but is a weak title nevertheless. The author, still searching, went from not so good to much worse, coming up with yet another title, With Due Respect. With Due Respect, that title is simply awful. Then the author made his final decision and called the book The Eye and the Ear. That had to be his final choice because Ernest Hemingway died before the book was published. His widow, Mary, had a better ear for titles. She took the book's final title from another manuscript. The book was published as A Movable Feast. Hemingway, one of the great innovators of 20th century American fiction, was often inept when it came to titling his work. One novel he at various times called As Others Are, The World's Room, They Who Get Shot, and The Carnal Education. Another title for that book was An Italian Chronicle, later changed to The Sentimental Education of Frederick Henry. By now you may have guessed that the book's final title was A Farewell to Arms, a resonant metaphor that lingers in the mind. And there you have the first clue as to what many great novel titles have in common, the use of metaphor. Another American author, winner of the Nobel Prize, had a novel that for a while he called Twilight. Not exactly a grabber that invites you to open to the first page. The author is William Faulkner. Does Twilight conjure up the energy of The Sound and the Fury? One way of enticing a reader is to title a novel with the name of the leading character plus an energizing factor. Saul Bellow's The Adventures of Augie March promises much more than the name, Augie March. His Henderson the Rain King resonates. The name Henderson would not. D.H. Lawrence discarded an inadequate title, Tenderness, before he called the book Lady Chatterley's Lover. It's hard to imagine that Scott Fitzgerald used Hurrah for the Red, White, and Blue before he hit on The Great Gatsby. What makes that title intriguing is the adjective great. When an author successfully builds a wide audience for his work, the title for his next and future books is usually his name. After The Naked and the Dead, any book of Norman Mailer's was sold as Norman Mailer's New Book rather than under its title. New York Magazine once had a competition for its readers to turn good titles into bad titles. Someone suggested downgrading Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead to The Nude and the Deceased. Though the words mean the same, the latter title for the same novel might have quashed the book's chances in the marketplace. An author presumably controls the title of his book, but he is subject to heavy influence from people on the publisher's staff. They are the money and the power. An author doesn't always get to exercise his prerogative when it comes to titles. I lost out once. I had a novel I called A Stopping Place. The jacket design included a swastika as a prominent feature. The title, In the Presence of the Swastika, had exactly the kind of low-key resonance I wanted for the book. However, shortly before press time, Publishers Weekly carried an announcement of a novel by an author in India who called his book A Stopping Place. Titles can't be copyrighted. Only motion picture titles can be protected by registration. I wanted to go ahead with my title, but the publisher was afraid there might be confusion in the marketplace. Reluctantly, and because everyone was in a hurry for a title change, I okayed the publisher's suggestion of The Resort as a title, though I never liked it. It had no resonance. The point to remember is that the primary function of a title is not to provide the locus of a story, but to entice the reader. Would you believe The Heart is a Lonely Hunter was once called The Mute? Or that The Red Badge of Courage was originally titled Private Fleming, His Various Battles? Or that The Blackboard Jungle went by the name To Climb the Wall? Is there a factor that, above all others, contributes to making a title intriguing and memorable? I've studied the titles that have captured the public imagination during my lifetime. Add to The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, The Red Badge of Courage, and The Blackboard Jungle the following titles that almost everyone seems to like, and ask yourself what they have in common. Tender is the Night, A Movable Feast, The Catcher in the Rye, The Grapes of Wrath. All seven of those titles are metaphors. They put two things together that don't ordinarily go together. They are intriguing, resonant, and provide exercise for the reader's imagination. A beginning writer might say, "Stein, those are all books by famous writers. What can we do?" A great deal. A good title, as I've said, can inspire a writer's work. One of the students in my advanced fiction seminar had problems with his work until he came up with an intriguing title, The Passionate Priest. He backed it up with an excellent first chapter that fit the title. Then, after our discussion about the metaphoric resonance of so many good titles, he came up with an even better one that drew immediate approval from all of his colleagues. A Heart is Full of Empty Rooms. Are there questions you might ask yourself about the title of your work? Yes. Does it sound fresh and new? Does it, like metaphor, bring together two things that haven't been together before? If not, is there a way of doing that with a variation of your present title? Can you use the name of the principal character in an interesting context? The point to remember is that the primary function of a title is not to convey meaning as much as to sound enticing and, if possible, exude resonance. Sometimes one is tempted to wax cynical about titles. Raymond Chandler once said, "A good title is the title of a successful book." That is certainly borne out by the book that won the 1993 National Book Award for Poetry. Its title was Garbage. Occasionally, a book with an awkward or bad title will somehow make it in the marketplace. Since my aim is to ease the writer's path to publication, I'll fall back on my experience as a publisher. A good title is like coming to a house you've never been in before and having the owner open the door and say, "Welcome." A good title can make a tremendous difference in the early acceptance of a book. Part 4. Nonfiction. Chapter 24. Using the Techniques of Fiction to Enhance Nonfiction. It is immensely valuable for the journalist, biographer, and other writers of nonfiction to examine the techniques that novelists and short story writers use. In editing many articles and hundreds of nonfiction books over the years, I worked on almost every conceivable kind, from childcare to philosophy, from books that, with hindsight, probably should not have been published, to works that zoomed high up on the bestseller lists or that became standard works. For our purposes here, I will divide all nonfiction into just two categories, practical and literary. There is some overlap, of course, but the basic distinctions are as follows. Practical nonfiction is designed to communicate information in circumstances where the quality of the writing is not considered as important as the content. Practical nonfiction appears mainly in popular magazines, newspapers, Sunday supplements, feature articles, and in self-help and how-to books. The subjects tend to be instruction, guides, tips, collections of facts, inside stories about a particular industry or locale or celebrated personalities, so-called inspirational material, popular psychology, medical, and other self-help for the layman. The vocabulary of practical nonfiction is usually as simple as is permitted by the subject matter. Literary nonfiction puts emphasis on the precise and skilled use of words and tone, and the assumption that the reader is as intelligent as the writer. While information is included, insight about that information, presented with some originality, may predominate. Sometimes the subject of literary nonfiction may not, at the outset, be of great interest to the reader, but the character of the writing may lure the reader into that subject. Literary nonfiction appears in books, in some general magazines such as The New Yorker, Harper's, The Atlantic, Commentary, The New York Review of Books, in many so-called little or small circulation magazines, in a few newspapers regularly and in some other newspapers from time to time, occasionally in a Sunday supplement, and in book review media. It should be no secret to readers of this book that I favor work in which the writer presents his best, not his quickest, and where the language used comes not from the top of the head, but from a consideration of precision, clarity, euphony, and alternatives. Reporting in nonfiction can be accurate, like a photograph taken merely to record. The best nonfiction, however, often sets what it sees in a framework, what has happened elsewhere or in the past. As the recorded events march before the reader, a scrim lifts to convey other dimensions. Sight becomes insight. Reporting becomes art. Like fiction, nonfiction accomplishes its purpose better when it evokes emotion in the reader. We might prefer everyone on earth to be rational, but the fact is that people are moved more by what they feel than by what they understand. Great orators, as well as great nonfiction writers, have always understood that. Nonfiction concerns itself with people, places, and ideas. Ideas seem to attract readers when developed through anecdotes involving people. Some nonfiction writers say they are jealous of novelists who create their characters. They are stuck with life, the characters in the news, the people they have to interview. No matter, the techniques for rounding the characters and making them come alive are similar. When the nonfiction writer reports to the reader about a living person, the writer has two options. He can characterize the person the way a layman would, or he can strive to give the person life on the page. In biography, the choice is clear. If the characters do not breathe, the exercise of assembling the facts of their lives may be of use to scholars, but not to readers. When it comes to making the people we write about in nonfiction spring to life on the page, the techniques are useful for all nonfiction writers, not just biographers and historians. Too often, though, what we get in newspapers and magazines is the person's name and title and little else, sometimes a photo or drawing. We may know what the person looks like, but we don't yet know the person. Characterization matters. The reader's attention to a story and the pleasure he derives from it is often measured by how alive the participants seem, which stems, of course, from the skill with which they are portrayed. It doesn't take much to make people come alive on the page. Novelists learn to provide vitality to minor characters in a sentence or two, usually by selecting one characteristic that is unusual. You will recall the beginning of Bud Schulberg's What Makes Sammy Run, in which the 16-year-old protagonist is described as a little ferret of a kid. Our dictionaries are full of animals, fish, birds, and insects that can be used in characterization of people. The wolf as predator, or someone who wolfs down food. The yearling as innocent. The toucan as beak-nosed. Falcons and hawks as high flyers. The bat, whose sonar for staying out of trouble is more effective than the sonar of most politicians. Plants, from the prickly cactus to the abrasive nettle, are also useful to help characterize. Live forevers, weeds, invasive clover, fast-growing fescue, wildflowers, are among the suggestive names of plants that a writer can use for brief and colorful characterizations. The best way to make a person come alive is by rendering the person's appearance with some specific detail. Here are some examples from articles, news stories, and books. See if you can detect the key words or phrases that characterize the person. The garage attendant's hat was parked perilously on an excessive amount of hair. This characterization has a touch of humor in that the verb parked is used for the garage attendant's hat. The visual image is of an ill-fitting cap that might fall off at any moment. It's enough to enliven this passing character. How do you enliven an accountant? His accountant is an owl of a man who keeps one eyelid half shut, not because of an affliction, but because there is much in this world he is not prepared to see. Note the key words and phrases. Owl characterizes the man physically. The rest of the sentence characterizes him psychologically. John Updike, who writes much nonfiction in addition to his celebrated novels, can characterize in a sentence. His face is so clean and rosy it looks skinned. A layman might describe a man as being dressed all in black. The image is vague. It gets the fact across, but not the feeling. It could have been written by anybody. Here's what Updike did, again in a nonfiction work. He sits by the little clubhouse in a golf cart wearing black. He is Greek. Where, after all these years in America, does he buy black clothes? His hat is black, his shirt is black. His eyes, though a bit rheumy with age now, are black, as are his shoes and their laces. Small black points exist in his face, like scattered punctuation. Markers that signal a person's background can be as useful to writers of nonfiction as to novelists, though few think of markers as a matter of course. Writers of articles, features, and books are more likely to use markers than journalists preparing copy on the run. If reporters try to use markers consciously a few times, it can become a rewarding habit. As an example of the use of markers in nonfiction, I've chosen excerpts from a front-page story about the hapless treasurer of Orange County, California, Robert L. Citron, from the New York Times of December 11, 1994. He was the type to wear, along with patent leather shoes and belts, red polyester pants and a green blazer at Christmas, pastels at Easter, and orange and black on Halloween. The license plate on Mr. Citron's car is LOVUSC, and until it broke, the horn was programmed to play the school's fight song. These markers, there are more, fit the main point of the story, that the Orange County treasurer who managed and lost billions was not a sophisticated Wall Street type, but a homespun local with unsophisticated tastes. The story focuses on the Santa Ana Elks Club, where Citron came for lunch routinely, arriving at 10 past noon and leaving at 1:10. Even the dining room of the Elks Club is described with markers. The decor is heavy on formica, naga hide, and styrofoam. On the tables, the only centerpieces are Keno coupons and bottles of Heinz ketchup and Michelhenny's Tabasco sauce. These markers of Mr. Citron's private time contrast with his role as a sophisticated, aggressive, and daring investor, whose high returns made him not only a legend in financial circles nationwide, but a hero to local politicians desperate to do more with less. Quick bites of television and the usual news stories told of Orange County's financial disaster, but did not capture the human drama of the man behind the collapse. The memorable account by reporter David Margalek that I am quoting ends with a comment from a man by the name of Fred Prendergast, a regular at Mr. Citron's table at the Elks. "To go to a man's home Sunday afternoon, intrude in his personal life, and practically force him to resign is the most cowardly thing a person could do," he said bitterly. "All they had to do was wait for 8 o'clock in the morning, or 7 in Bob's case, and he'd have been right in his office where he's supposed to be. They treated him like an animal." With the aid of markers and particularity, Margalek made Robert L. Citron visible the way photographs of the man do not, and gave a news story a human face and the ring of tragedy. The nonfiction writer who becomes aware of the emotions elicited by cultural differences can use this power in representing people by well-chosen class markers. Often the writer's job is to characterize public figures in depth. I've selected an example from a work of history, a classic that has sold far more copies than many bestsellers. Most people have at least an idea as to what Lenin, the founder of the Soviet Union, looked like. Paintings and sculpture, seen in books and on TV, have carried the often romanticized image. Some photographs bring us closer to the truth. But a skilled writer can give us not only exact images, but a sense of personality. In the following paragraph, both Lenin and his brother Alexander are characterized. Alexander's face was long and brooding, his skin milky white, his hair thick, turbulent, frizzy, deep-rooted, stood up in all directions from a line far down on his forehead. His eyes, set deep and on a strange angle in a knobby, overhanging brow, seemed to turn their gaze inward. It was the strongly chiseled face of a dreamer, a saint, a devotee, an ascetic. But Vladimir's face was shaped like an egg, and the thin fringe of reddish hair began to recede from the forehead before he was 20, leaving him bald like his father in young manhood. His complexion was a blend of grayishness and full-bloodedness, his eyes tiny, twinkling, mongoloid. His whole aspect, except in moments of intense thought or anger, was jovial, humorous, mischievous, self-confident, aggressive. Not knowing him, one might have taken him, in later years, for a hard-working kulak, a rising provincial official, a shrewd businessman. There was nothing in his build or appearance or temperament to suggest kinship with his brother Alexander. The excerpt is from Bertram D. Wolfe's Three Who Made a Revolution. One of the strengths in the description of Lenin is the evocation of what he looked like earlier and later. That's a technique all writers can employ under appropriate circumstances. Note the liberties taken by the author. Alexander's hair is turbulent. It is also deeply rooted. How could the author know? Which conveys its permanence, as contrasted with Lenin's baldness. Lenin is compared to three different types: a kulak, a well-off farmer, a provincial official, a businessman. Is taking risks, as this author has, irresponsible in nonfiction? The Dean of American Literary Critics of this century, Edmund Wilson, referred to the book from which this paragraph was taken as the best book in its field in any language. It's worth taking risks. If it doesn't work, it will be apparent when you revise. What if the subject of an article or a book is well known to at least part of your audience, as would be the case with, say, Franklin D. Roosevelt? What can a nonfiction writer do that is fresh and new in characterization when dealing with someone whose history has been the object of intensive research by many writers? One interview with Betsy Whitney is the basis for the extraordinary first paragraph of Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, No Ordinary Time. On nights filled with tension and concern, Franklin Roosevelt performed a ritual that helped him to fall asleep. He would close his eyes and imagine himself at Hyde Park as a boy, standing with his sled in the snow atop the steep hill that stretched from the south porch of his home to the wooded bluffs of the Hudson River far below. As he accelerated down the hill, he maneuvered each familiar curve with perfect skill until he reached the bottom, whereupon, pulling his sled behind him, he started slowly back up until he reached the top, where he would once more begin his descent. Again and again he replayed this remembered scene in his mind, obliterating his awareness of the shrunken legs beneath the sheets, undoing the knowledge that he would never climb a hill or even walk on his own power again. Thus liberating himself from his paralysis through an act of imaginative will, the President of the United States would fall asleep. The evening of May 9, 1940, was one of these nights. At 11 p.m., as Roosevelt sat in his comfortable study on the second floor of the White House, the long-apprehended phone call had come. That paragraph, like much of the book, is filled with visual particularity and action. Goodwin's book is worth studying for its technique in using research, all of it documented, not only to characterize historical persons, but to provide the reader with a rich experience. Here is a checklist of questions you can ask yourself when characterizing. Would the reader be able to identify the person you're writing about if he was seen in a group of 10 people? Have you done anything with the person's eyes, the way they are used, to look at a person or to look away? Have you given the reader a sense of how that person feels through describing an action, rather than by stating the person's feelings? Does your person have a habit like tapping a finger, pointing eyeglasses, laughing too loud, waving his hands in a particular way that would make him more visible? Is there anything individual about the gait or posture of the person? Can you lend resonance to your characterization by invoking other matters in which your person was involved? Has your person changed much? In a longer work, can you use that change? Setting a scene goes hand in hand with characterization. Suppose someone described a scene from history this way. Mary Stuart came into the great hall, followed by her retinue. She climbed the stairs to her chair, faced her audience, and smiled. The reader gets the information, the facts, but not the essence of the occasion, and it is the essence that conveys truth. There is no reason why nonfiction writers cannot do as well as novelists in conveying a scene. Witness what historian Garrett Mattingly did in introducing Mary Stuart in The Armada. She entered through a little door at the side, and before they saw her was already in the great hall, walking toward the dais, six of her own people, two by two, behind her, oblivious to the stir and rustle as her audience craned forward, oblivious, apparently, of the officer on whose sleeve her hand rested, walking as quietly, thought one pious soul, as if she were going to her prayers. Only for a moment, as she mounted the steps, and before she sank back into the black-draped chair, did she seem to need the supporting arm, and if her hands trembled before she locked them in her lap, no one saw. Then, as if acknowledging the plaudits of a multitude, though the hall was very still, she turned for the first time to face her audience, and, some thought, she smiled. How much Mattingly gets into part of one paragraph, all of it designed to make a scene he never saw real to the reader. The difference between ordinary nonfiction and extraordinary writing, as in Mattingly, is often in the resonance. Against the black velvet of the chair and dais, her figure, clad in black velvet, was almost lost. The gray winter daylight dulled the gleam of white hands, the glint of yellow gold in her kerchief, and of red gold in the piled masses of auburn hair beneath. But the audience could see clearly enough the delicate frill of white lace at her throat and above it, a white heart-shaped petal against the blackness, the face with its great dark eyes and tiny wistful mouth. This was she for whom Rizzio had died, and Darnley, the young fool, and Huntley, and Norfolk, and Babington, and a thousand nameless men on the moors and gallows of the north. This was she whose legend had hung over England like a sword ever since she had galloped across its borders with her subjects in pursuit. This was the last captive princess of romance, the Dowager Queen of France, the exiled Queen of Scotland, the heir to the English throne, and, there must have been some among the silent witnesses who thought so, at this very moment, if she had rights, England's lawful queen. This was Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots. For a moment she held all their eyes, then she sank back into the darkness of her chair and turned her grave inattention to her judges. She was satisfied that her audience would look at no one else. Note how Mattingly conveys the strength of her presence in the last lines of that paragraph. He is characterizing a strong queen for whom many had died. Is he making things up? The writing, quite apart from Mattingly's considerable reputation as a historian, convinces us that the author has feasted on every scrap of eyewitness testimony and on paintings to convey that scene. Lest you conclude that resonance is available only to the writer of history, here is a paragraph from James Baldwin's essay about his father from his first published nonfiction book, Notes of a Native Son. Note how the drive to the graveyard blossoms into so much more. A few hours after my father's funeral, while he lay in state in the undertaker's chapel, a race riot broke out in Harlem. On the morning of the 3rd of August, we drove my father to the graveyard through a wilderness of smashed plate glass. The day of my father's funeral had also been my 19th birthday. As we drove him to the graveyard, the spoils of injustice, anarchy, discontent, and hatred were all around us. It seemed to me that God himself had devised, to mark my father's end, the most sustained and brutally dissonant of codas. And it seemed to me, too, that the violence which rose all about us as my father left the world had been devised as a corrective for the pride of his eldest son. I had declined to believe in that apocalypse which had been central to my father's vision. Very well, life seemed to be saying. Here is something that will certainly pass for an apocalypse until the real thing comes along. I had inclined to be contemptuous of my father for the conditions of his life, for the conditions of our lives. When his life had ended, I began to wonder about that life, and also, in a new way, to be apprehensive about my own. Chapter 25. Conflict, Suspense, and Tension in Nonfiction. Are the techniques of plotting any use to the nonfiction writer? All storytelling from the beginning of recorded time is based on somebody wanting something, facing obstacles, not getting it, trying to get it, trying to overcome obstacles, and finally getting or not getting what he wanted. What has interested listeners, readers, and viewers for centuries is available in the conscious use of desire in nonfiction. In life, we prefer an absence of conflict. In what we read, an absence of conflict means an absence of stimulation. Few things are as boring as listening to uncontested testimony in a courtroom. Few things are as interesting as a courtroom clash. If Marjorie and Richard lived happily ever after, the reader's response is, "So what?" In articles, newspaper stories, and books, the reader's interest often flags because the writer did not keep in mind that dramatic conflict has been the basis of stories from the beginning of time. Conflict does not have to involve violence. Conflict can be low-key. It can exist by innuendo. What it takes is a mindset when examining the cast of a prospective piece, whether it is to be an article or a scene in a book. Are there two people, two parties, two organizations, or two entities of any kind that are in conflict? If the conflict might not be immediately apparent to the reader, can the writer provide some help by bringing the conflicting elements closer to each other and by highlighting the conflict, actual or potential? Conflict can arise from a thwarted desire, but the desire must be planted. Here's a simple before and after example. Terrence McNeese, 14, was arraigned yesterday in town court for allegedly stealing a bicycle belonging to a neighbor. Watch what happens when desire is added. According to the testimony of his mother, Terrence McNeese wanted a bicycle more than anything in the world, but she couldn't afford to buy him one. Terrence, age 14, was arraigned yesterday in town court for allegedly stealing a bicycle belonging to a neighbor. In the first part of the example, the information that a boy has been arrested for stealing a bicycle comes across as dispassionate fact. It's rather blah. The revised version, in which we learn that the boy wanted a bicycle more than anything else in the world and that his mother couldn't afford to buy him one, tugs at the reader's emotions. What has been activated is the boy's desire for the bike, which is more powerful than the act of stealing. A news story or a nonfiction piece can move a reader more if the writer remembers that desire, wanting something important badly, can be a force. The more important the objective, the bigger the conflict will seem to the reader if there are obstacles in the way of gratifying the want. The thing that's wanted may not be possible. Nevertheless, the reader can have his emotions stimulated by that unrealistic and unattainable want. When the writer has his material and is ready to begin writing, that's the time to determine whether any of the people in the story he is about to write want something badly. Bringing that material up to the beginning could help touch a match to the reader's emotions. One of the best guides for planning nonfiction is the Actor's Studio method for developing drama in plots that I described in Chapter 7. It involves giving each character in a scene a different tack. That technique can be adapted to nonfiction. In preparing to write any passage or scene involving two people, if the writer focuses on their differing intentions, or scripts, he will immediately see the dramatic advantages of positioning their conflict in many kinds of adversarial situations in which conflict is inherent in the circumstances. Doris Kearns Goodwin's remarkable book, No Ordinary Time, focuses on the home front in World War II and on Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. All couples in a relationship have differing scripts, but the Roosevelts are a dramatic example of the point. Eleanor was motivated by humanitarian causes, Franklin by politics. Their intentions clashed frequently, made more complex by their extramarital friendships. Yet as a public couple, especially as Franklin became governor and president, they were trapped in a crucible. You will recall from Chapter 8 that crucible is an emotional or physical environment that bonds two people, and that characters caught in a crucible won't declare a truce. They're in it till the end. Their motivation to continue opposing each other is greater than their motivation to run away. The story of the Roosevelts, in expert hands, is as moving as the exemplary novels whose characters are trapped in a crucible. Though the crucible is as applicable to confrontations of people as it is to fictional characters, I have never known a non-fiction writer who employed the idea consciously. Yet it has been used in countless histories and biographies, both of which invite scenes in which two adversaries are locked in a situation that holds them together more than anything would drive them apart. Nonfiction writing would be more dramatic and tap the reader's emotions more if the crucible were considered more often in the planning stage. Suspense is a valuable technique for the writer who wants to make his reader keep turning pages. It occurs when the reader expects something to happen, and it isn't happening yet because the author is holding it off. For instance, if a person has been characterized in an interesting way and the reader learns that the character is in danger, the reader wants to know how the person gets out of danger. If that information is withheld for a while, the reader will be left in suspense. If trouble is in the offing, the reader hopes that the person will find out in time to prevent the bad event from occurring. A variant occurs when the reader wants something to happen to a character and it isn't happening yet. Nonfiction writers do not think of suspense as a conscious method for enhancing reader interest in their work, though some writers use suspense instinctively. Let's look at a simple example from a newspaper story of how suspense can be implanted. A bus carrying 13 passengers to Mount St. Vincent yesterday evening careened off the road into a gully. One of the passengers, Henry Pazitaki, died before the ambulance reached the scene. Six other persons were hospitalized, two critically. There is no element of suspense in that first paragraph. The story continues. Three of the passengers with minor injuries told patrolman George Francesi investigating the accident that the driver may have been drinking. A spokesman for the Tri-State Bus Company denied those allegations. Accusation and denial rendered, no suspense. Here's how a writer, conscious of the benefit of suspense, might have written the same story. A bus carrying 13 passengers to Mount St. Vincent yesterday evening careened off the road into a gully. One of those passengers never made it to Mount St. Vincent. A spokesperson for the Tri-State Bus Company said, "The driver is a teetotaler. There is no evidence that he was drinking despite what some of the passengers said. It was an accident." The first sentence tells us what happened to the bus. The second sentence arouses curiosity as to who was the passenger who didn't make it. The purposeful repetition of Mount St. Vincent helps set up the suspense. The second paragraph doesn't tell us who the person is. The switch to a different part of the story, the spokesperson for the bus company, heightens the suspense. The reader wants to know more. Another element of suspense is introduced. Was the driver drunk or not? The last paragraph of the story reads, "Patrolman George Francesi, investigating the accident, said, 'Three other passengers with minor injuries complained that the driver appeared to have been drinking. Rosella Carew, who was sitting just behind Henry Pazitaki, the man who was killed, said, "I had doubts about getting on the bus when I saw the driver's eyeglasses in his lap, and he didn't even seem to know it.'" This method of handling the story not only provides conflict for reader interest, at the end it lets the reader draw his own conclusion. The following true story demonstrates how suspense can be built and maintained in nonfiction through a consistent point of view in which the reader learns only what the narrator knows, and learns it when the narrator learns it. A friend of ours let us have the use of her condo in Florida during a period of icy weather in the East. It was a cozy place, fully equipped, with only one problem. The dishwasher disgorged water all over the kitchen floor. My wife went down to the superintendent's apartment, his name is Roger, and knocked on the door. He didn't answer. This was Friday. Could it be his day off? I met Roger the first day we were there. He helped us with our luggage. I tried to tip him for helping us with the bags, but he waved the bills away. I guessed Roger to be in his late 30s, maybe a couple of years older. Later, from the window, I watched him washing the cars of residents, which seemed to give him a lot of pleasure. No car wash in the world could do the job as meticulously as Roger did. I saw him doing small repairs around the place. Whenever I passed him, I stopped to exchange a sentence or two. I think Roger was slightly retarded, a nice man with a personality a lot more pleasant than most of the people around him who had all their marbles. Come Saturday morning, my wife went down to Roger's apartment again. Still no answer. I thumbed through the yellow pages, and after four tries got a plumber who was working on Saturdays and who promised to show up in an hour. He showed up 3 hours later, did a quick fix on the dishwasher, but cautioned us that a pipe leading to the dishwasher needed replacing, and urged us to tell the superintendent. I didn't see Roger around at all on Saturday. On Sunday, I looked out of our second-story window and saw several policemen clustered around the door of Roger's apartment. I hurried down and was intercepted by a neighbor. "Roger's dead," he said. "Where?" "In his apartment." All I could think was, "He's so young." He seemed strong and healthy the way he hoisted our bags. The policemen weren't saying anything except that the body was still in the apartment and they were waiting for the coroner. Hours later, from my window, I saw the body bag being carried out. By the time I got downstairs, the police were gone. 2 days later, I was about to drive out of the underground garage when I saw Roger and a young girl moving stuff out of his apartment. I thought he was dead. Who was in the body bag? I stopped the car and got out to tell Roger how glad I was he was alive and to find out what happened. The man had a stammer. I didn't remember Roger stammering. It turned out that the man was Roger's twin brother, who'd come a distance and, with his daughter's help, was piling Roger's belongings onto a pickup truck. "Not the bed," the brother said, shaking his head. From him I learned that Roger had suffered a silent heart attack, probably on Thursday night, since he didn't respond to my wife's knock Friday morning. Because he must have felt very cold, Roger put one electric blanket under himself and another on top. He burned all day Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. "The funeral," the twin brother said, "will be closed casket." If I had started to recount what had happened by saying the superintendent of the building I was staying in burned to death last weekend, it would have spoiled the story by telegraphing the outcome. That's what we do in life. Our instinct is to give the conclusion first. As storytellers, we have to hold back by telling the story from a consistent point of view, in this case mine, and showing what happened as I learned about it. I didn't refer to Roger as the superintendent. I called him by his name. I said a couple of things to humanize him. I particularized as often as possible. But most important, I stuck to one point of view. I didn't say more than I found out at any time. I conveyed what I learned in the same order that I learned it, thus giving the entire story a consistent point of view. In considering suspense, you might want to refer to the following checklist. Can your first paragraph arouse curiosity by withholding a piece of information till a bit later? Does your story set up a question or controversy and not answer or resolve it immediately? Are you loading in facts that unnecessarily diminish suspense early? Have you described an action that may arouse curiosity, but that isn't explained in the same paragraph? Can you convert any sentence to a question that will arouse curiosity rather than satisfy it? In considering the creation of tension in nonfiction, let's keep the difference between tension and suspense in mind. Suspense arouses a feeling of anxious uncertainty in the reader about what might happen, or a hope that something bad won't happen. Tension usually involves the sudden onset of a feeling of stress, strain, or pressure. As I've pointed out earlier, we deplore suspense and tension in life and enjoy them in writing. Tension can be created by the simple mention of a time or date. "It was 4 o'clock in the morning" creates tension because it's an hour when most people are asleep. Therefore, anything that happens at 4 in the morning is in itself tension-producing, or could be. It's the could-be factor that creates tension in the reader because he expects tension as part of his experience. Two authors whose books I edited, Gordon Thomas and Max Morgan Witz, collaborated on a number of nonfiction disaster books that were hugely successful. They specialized in moment-by-moment reconstructions of cataclysmic events in such books as The Day the World Ended, The San Francisco Earthquake, Shipwreck, and Voyage of the Damned. Voyage was the story of the luxury liner St. Louis, one of the last ships to leave Nazi Germany before World War II erupted. We know at the outset that the 937 passengers, all Jews fleeing Nazi Germany, are in danger. If Cuba does not let them in, the ship will return its human cargo to the Nazis, and many will die. The first chapter is headed Wednesday, May 3rd, 1939. That pre-war date in itself is enough to put tension to work. The second chapter is headed Thursday, May 4th, 1939. The tension increases. Therefore, each time a date appears, the reader's pulse quickens. That's tension at work. Let's examine how tension can be induced in a simple sequence. Here's the way it was originally written. The suspect refused to obey the policeman's order to come out of his automobile. No tension. Now the same event as edited. The policeman ordered the suspect to come out of his automobile. The suspect didn't move. What creates the tension is separating the two parts of the action. The separation in the example is momentary. The continuation of tension over paragraphs and pages comes from stretching out a tense situation, often a confrontation between persons or groups. Let's look at the cop and the suspect again. The policeman ordered the suspect to come out of his automobile. The suspect didn't move. Bystanders reported that the officer then drew his gun and in a loud voice said, "Get out, now!" The suspect shook his head and stayed put. You can see how stretching out a sequence of acts produces tension that the reader finds pleasurable. Short sentences and short paragraphs help increase tension. A common error is the writer's temptation to rush to a conclusion. In life, we savor good experiences and long for them to continue. The rush to end a good experience is counterproductive. The writer must discipline himself to hold back. Chapter 26, Quoting What They Say. Dialogue is an area in which the interests of fiction writers and nonfiction writers diverge. For the novelist, dialogue provides immediacy to a scene and is a major contributor to the experience of fiction. For the writer of articles and books, as well as journalism, dialogue is a danger unless one uses direct quotes that sound real and can be substantiated. Those are two quite different matters. Recording what people actually say does not read well. It is frequently hesitant, wordy, repetitive, and ultimately boring, as court transcripts prove. The nonfiction writer has remedies. If you quote anyone for more than three sentences, that's a speech. Break it up with something visual. It needn't be elaborate. Craig Marshall was the first to speak. "The issues, count on it, are threefold," he said. "In two sections of the village, tap water is the color of, call it mud, been that way for 30 years, and the incumbents have done nothing about it." Marshall coughed against his closed fist. "Item two," he continued, "is the traffic nightmare from the sports complex. Anybody in this village has a heart attack when the traffic's letting out can count on the ambulance getting to him in 2 or 3 hours." He looked pointedly at the mayor. "That's a death sentence for somebody, because as far as I can tell, the Almighty hasn't given this community an exemption from heart attacks." The writer has broken up the quote with seemingly inconsequential things like a cough and looking at somebody. The first interruption humanizes the speaker and adds to the reality. The second, a glance at the mayor, invokes a suspicion of conflict by seeming to blame the mayor for the problems the speaker is talking about. I saw the first draft, in which the speaker had two windy sentences that contributed absolutely nothing of importance and made the speaker sound like Dwight Eisenhower searching for the end of a sentence. The reporter left them out not to protect the reputation of Mr. Marshall, but to prevent his copy from being boring. In reporting spoken words, it is not a writer's obligation to reproduce all of the words as long as the speaker's meaning is preserved. Few people speak in complete and grammatical sentences. Moreover, perfectly formed sentences often come across to the reader as made up. In this instance, the reporter did a good job of catching the flavor of what was said. In quoting, the writer has to beware of cleaning up a speaker's sentences. In 1975, just 30 days before Jimmy Hoffa, icon of the Teamsters Union, disappeared from the face of the earth, he came to lunch, bringing along, at my suggestion, the man who was ghosting his autobiography. Hoffa's material had been recorded on tape. The material, as spoken by Hoffa, was fascinating and colorful. That same material, with Hoffa's rough language cleaned up and sentences straightened out, was unreal and boring. The purpose of the meeting was to insist that the writer restore Hoffa's words, including the expletives and grammatical howlers. I wasn't urging for a verbatim transcript of the tapes, but for a retention of their color, which I succeeded in getting, and which all writers who deal with the spoken words of others should strive for. When you're reporting the results of an interview, you will likely end up with too much quotation. You want to keep those parts that reveal the character of the speaker or that define subject matter. You want to preserve comments that are confrontational, colorful, or especially appropriate, and ditch the rest. That brings us to the second matter. Never intentionally misquote, and never invent dialogue. Invented dialogue is usually a highly visible sign of untrustworthy writing. A few writers of nonfiction commit the same errors as some historical novelists. They provide dialogue that would have been impossible for anyone to record. I know of cases in which books were rejected by editors because some piece of attributed dialogue was so apparently contrived that it cast doubt on the reliability of the author for facts that could not easily be confirmed. Don't tempt rejection by an editor or a lawsuit from a person quoted inaccurately. If you find yourself inventing dialogue, write a play, novel, or movie.